Hello, and welcome back to the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast. If this is your first time joining us, I hope you enjoy your stay. I'm your host, Michael.
And I'm your host, Zach.
As we discussed in our recent Year in Review episode, in many ways, 2023 was the year of AI in the tech industry. Klaviyo was no exception to that. As longtime listeners know, Klaviyo has embraced the potential of AI starting years ago at this point. But as the field has evolved, Klaviyo has invested more heavily into AI and become more of an environment where AI is leading the way rather than just patching holes here and there. Part of the reason for that is the advance in large language models, or LLMs, made building solutions for a lot of use cases substantially easier and lower cost than it ever has been before. Today, we're going to give an example of how a team at Klaviyo used AI to help our customers through a feature called Segments AI. We've brought on four members of the team who built that feature. Let's do a quick round of introductions. Who are you and what do you do at Klaviyo? Let's go ahead and start off with Carola.
Hello, everyone. I'm Carola Leiva. I'm a product manager working on AI features at Klaviyo.
Fantastic. Happy to have you back on. And Manuel, you're up next.
Hi, everyone. My name is Manuel. I'm the engineering manager for Natural Language Interfaces. The NLI, or Natural Language Interfaces team, is the engineering team supporting some of our AI features.
Fantastic. Rob, you're up next.
Sure. My name is Robert Huslid. I'm a senior data scientist here at Klaviyo, and I typically work on NLP stuff.
Excellent. And Alex?
Hello. I'm Alex Holness, and I am a senior lead product designer at Klaviyo, working on all sorts of AI projects here.
Fantastic. Welcome on the podcast for the first time, and welcome back the rest of you. It is a great group here. I think we're going to have a great discussion, and I'm excited. Thank you all for coming on the show today. Zach, you want to take us away?
Absolutely. So as always with a feature, we're going to start by setting the stage. So let's explain a little bit of the why behind this feature. What is a segment, and what were some of the pain points in using them that inspired what ultimately became Segments AI?
I can jump on explain what a segment is first. A segment, you can imagine, is like a subgroup of people. So let's say you have a business, and I'm going to give an example just to put it more concrete. You have a business that sells perfumes in the United States. You have customers across the country. Those customers interact in different ways with your brand, and they like different products. Some people, perfumes are a little bit more floral. So other people are like more sweet. I don't know so much about perfumes, but I'm just trying to give an example that is very concrete. So people have different preferences. So if you want to connect with your customers to keep close relationship with them, because you would want to know them, so you had to know who they are. You have to know what they like and basically personalize the message to exactly what they are looking for. So you need to bring down all your customers in like different smaller groups. So those are segments. So they are subgroup of people. And segment can be created based on conditions, and conditions are, like, as I was saying, behaviors, interests, and personal characteristics of the people. So for example, again, the same example of the perfume, you may want to divide your customers based on the region. So you want to maybe like reach out to people in Boston, different from the people that you're reaching out in, people in California, or you can divide them by like type of perfume. Or you can do it like as like smaller as you want. And you can say, I want to message people in Boston that have bought a perfume in the last 30 days and also like a specific brand, very detailed. So that's basically segment. And the second part of your question is that why this behind this feature? Why are we working on this? Basically, again, because we want to personalize communication, and our current set of features in to build segments, it requires a little bit of knowledge of the tool and is not straightforward to understand. And basically, people think about how they want to segment people.
Right now, the way you build a segment in Klaviyo is kind of a technical user experience. You have to learn a series of dropdowns and metric names and/or logic. And that can be kind of intimidating for a lot of users and confusing. You don't necessarily always know how to translate the profile that's in your head or the group of customers that's in your head into the logic that's required to retrieve those profiles from your database. There's also the challenge of some users might know exactly what they want to build or the segment that they want to build. Other users might have only kind of a vague idea of what they want to build. Maybe they know that they want engaged profiles or unengaged profiles, but they don't necessarily know exactly how that translates into a sequence of logic that would pull those customers.
Yeah, and we kind of think it's a missed opportunity because segments are incredibly powerful to be able to, someone who doesn't know SQL, for example, like pull what are the customers that have bought my brown shirt number 12 twice in the past week and be able to target your messaging to only go to folks like them and have all this information kept up to date by a service that you don't have to maintain. So it's a really powerful tool that we just want folks to get more use from.
Segments are really the building block to a lot of tooling in Klaviyo. If you want to send a campaign, you're going to have to pick an audience that you send that campaign to. If you want to set up a flow that's triggered by when somebody joins a segment, you're going to have a segment at the foundation of that experience. So it felt kind of like a good place to start.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I think that gives us a good idea of kind of why segments matter and just what segments are. So I guess that gives us the segments part of segments AI. Why AI? Why did we think an LLM-based solution seemed like it would actually be a good fit for this set of problems?
Sure. Well, I mean, going back to kind of what I said earlier about users struggling to translate what is in their head into what's built in the tool, AI does that for you. Natural language inputs, you know, you can actually just, all you need to do is verbalize what's in your head, say it with your own natural words, and the AI can actually generate that for you. You don't need to learn our classic interface. You don't need to learn the and/or logic. You just need to speak what's in your head into the tool.
And to build upon that is that AI can not only understand how you're talking, so you don't have to learn something new, it can do it faster. So it's like easier and faster, which is like two things that customers are looking for when they're working in Klaviyo or any other tool.
Yeah, I'd say previously we didn't try to automate this type of task before kind of recent advances in LLM technology, because it's a really non-trivial thing. It's fundamentally a creative task of like, if someone says engage users, what that means for the metrics you have in your account, for the type of business you are, it requires a lot of what we might think of as critical thinking. And with the latest generation of LLMs, we can kind of roughly approximate that. So it's something we're now able to do, and we're excited to be able to roll out those type of functionalities.
I guess along those lines, are there any specific common use cases we were looking to easily automate that we couldn't before? I guess it sounds like engaged or unengaged is a good example. Were there any other common ones?
I think Rob was mentioning this, Alex too, is that basically cases that customers are not sure what to do. They don't know specifically the conditions. They may have ideas. And I would basically talk to a person and they will say, I want to connect with this type of customer, engage 30 days. And I'm not sure exactly what is the conditions that I had to use. So anything that is more ambiguous, I do not specifically know the conditions, is a case that we wanted to help customers, because that is not only faster, but also it allows you, as Alex was saying before, to go from natural language to something that is more specific and customer doesn't have to learn the specific conditions to use.
I would like to add something to that. I definitely agree with what we mentioned about building segments AI for non-tech savvy people, or people that are not very familiar with the complexity of the feature. But I think that building segments AI, we also discovered that we have also built things for those advanced users too. And I'll share an example, like the current segment builder. So if you really know what you're looking for, I think that segments AI can also allow you to do it faster, to Corolla's point. One example we've seen like multiple times is people copying like a huge list of things that they may be copying from a different tool. I think that's also like something great that it's enabled just by having a natural language input. And specific examples, like people are trying to target specific cities or specific zip codes, they may have the list from a different tool that they are using. And just doing that context switching between the tools was very problematic. It would require a lot of clicks. It's error prone because, I don't know, maybe you accidentally selected, I don't know, the third or fifth time that you were adding a different zip code, you were selecting a different attribute. So I think this also like allowed them to do that kind of copy-pasting, let's say, faster and reducing the potential errors in that process.
Right, because for context, if I remember correctly, something like zip codes, there isn't like zip code is one of as an option. You have to use a bunch of or conditions, right?
That is correct. Yeah, right now, like changing like all of those classes is not trivial. When you have, let's say, many values for one single property, like it would occur. Very redundant type of work where you'll have to like repeat the same thing over and over again for the multiple values.
Yeah, I'd say another example of that is you want to say someone that lives within 20 miles of one of your three locations that are in Boston, SF, LA. You don't have to look up what is the specific zip code that's center of town for each of those different places. You can kind of rely on LLM's general knowledge of the entire internet to be able to pull those type of thing. So it's a quality of life update for folks that build lots and lots of segments.
You're talking about some pretty advanced specific use cases there. And this kind of gets back to what you're talking about before, Rob, of the general versatility of solving this pretty non-trivial problem. I guess for all of you, were there any things that this AI-based approach could just understand intuitively that you were particularly surprised by or impressed by?
Yeah, so one thing that was kind of cool is it responds reasonably well in different languages. I mean, it's not probably the most important feature. It's just kind of a nice to have, given that most of Klaviyo users would be using English, but if you're not a native English speaker, yeah, it's a nice to have. I would say one of the things we really tried to develop over time is ability to kind of go from a vague input that maybe doesn't have a prescriptive solution to a useful output maybe the person wasn't thinking of. So one example that we kind of thought of during this process is like input of people who are students. In your data schema, there almost certainly would not be a Boolean true or false, is this person a student? And then if you go into like their title or something, student is not really a title in English. So initially, like our models had trouble translating that into a segment. I think a normal person probably would struggle for a while. But ultimately, we kind of were able to like poke and prod our models to be a bit more creative. Something now that the model does is if you say people who are students, it'll say email address contains .edu, for example. So trying to embed that type of like creative thinking was something that was both difficult and ultimately pretty rewarding when it works.
I would like to add one little example too on something that we were surprised about when we started testing. And I think it's related to the inspirational part of the tool, also related to the ambiguous inputs that Rob was mentioning. When we were testing this tool, we tested regular things that are common in marketing, like churn. So I think that one of the good things about the tool is that if you're exploring certain concepts, you can iterate on your prompts and get basically different definitions. And that may even allow you to come up with your own definition of churn after what you're learning from the tool. I think that was very, very interesting. And that's, of course, like based on the understanding of what churn means for the internet that the LLM has been able to learn in that process. But that was very interesting. Like if you start iterating and you'll get different definitions, it's kind of it's very good for certain use cases, less for other use cases. So it really depends on what you're looking for. But if you're looking for like inspiration, I think the tool also allows for that.
It's also been fun to see our users discover that, and surprising. I think we all kind of expected the users that enjoy the tool to be using it because of the time that it saves. It gets them a segment faster than they normally would be able to get it. But what surprised me was how many users are actually using it just to be inspired or figure out how to pull a certain profile property that they didn't know maybe what it was named as. You know, they wanted students, but they didn't know how to find it in their database, or they wanted inspiration of how to define a certain set of conditions. And yeah, they're actually going into the tool just to learn a bit and discover a bit. And then they're going back to the classic tool to do it the old-fashioned way. So we're seeing the tool not just be a total replacement of the old. We're seeing users really interact with both and pick and choose which makes sense at the right moment in their experience, which has been very interesting.
So this isn't the first AI helps you do something or AI makes something for you feature that Klaviyo has built. We were using much earlier large language model-based solutions to help our customers do things like write subject lines, for instance. So what makes segments distinct or unique from some of those other use cases that we've thought about and implemented here at Klaviyo?
I think it's taking kind of the next step forward with our AI tooling. You know, in the past, most of our tooling has been focused around content generation. Now, this new wave of tooling is about completing actual tasks in Klaviyo, providing a new user experience in Klaviyo, and creating steps toward full-on marketing, not just the words on a page. It's a lot more than that.
Building up on that, so as Alex was saying, is that this is the first time that we create an object. We were focused mostly in content, and this is the first step, reinforcing Alex's message. This is the first step to build bigger things. She was saying earlier that segment is one component of campaigns, flows, like many other things that customers can do in the tool. How do we work towards something bigger? How do we work to help customers to basically interact with the tool in a more friendly way that is not required to learn? So this is just the first to do that path of automation and make it easier interactions in the tool.
Yeah, so I think what you're getting at there is like, why do this? Why build another LLM feature? It seems like every website is rushing to try to get their name mentioned next to AI and have a bunch of clippies in the corner of your screen. And I think how you kind of get around that, break through the noise, is you need to actually provide value to people and not novelty. So being able to like help them speed up or generate new interesting segments that they otherwise wouldn't, I think is valuable. Getting our team like more experience on these type of text to object internal tasks, really valuable.
Alex, I wanted to follow up on something that we briefly talked about before this episode. You brought up what I would like to kind of call the AI chicken and egg question, which is, for something like Segments AI, which comes first, the model or the UX?
Yeah, this is a challenge when designing with AI in general, not just in this specific project. In a more traditional design process, you might sketch out some ideas, maybe prototype something, test your concept with users, and through that, you're able to get kind of a general understanding of the value that you're bringing to a user and the way they might interact with that feature were you to go ahead and build it. When you're designing with AI or designing for AI, there's a little bit more of a gamble and a little bit more of a dance. If your model isn't built yet, it's really hard to test your design to understand that value or how users will use it. You really don't know yet. You can't test what they're going to put into the tool if you don't have the model itself. You know, when I go into user testing before we've actually built anything, I hear a lot from users, can it do this? Can the model do that? What can it do? I don't know what to say. I don't know what to put in here. And I'm like, well, we don't know yet. What would you put in there? And it's kind of this dance that you're doing of figuring out how they would use a tool before that tool actually exists. And then at the same time, on the data science side and the modeling side, in order to build that model, you kind of want to get some idea of what a user is going to put into the tool. So it's kind of like, what comes first, the model or the user experience? And it's just a different type of design process than your typical one. You kind of really have to build both simultaneously and learn and bounce off of each other as it gets built iteratively.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the UI has definitely changed and the model has definitely changed as we kind of identified parts we want to improve based on things that we didn't expect the model to be good at or bad at. It's like, oh, if this type of output is uncertain, how can we like explain that to users? And so the UI changes. If we want to make it more interactive, how can we adjust the model to try to like incorporate that? So it kind of really goes both ways.
Yeah. So when you're ultimately creating the user experience side of it, because there are some unknowns, because you can't necessarily build the entire model perfectly right out of the gate that satisfies every possible user input that will ever happen, that's just not going to happen. You have to design the interface in a way that builds transparency. It helps educate the user about how to use the tool. It sort of creates that feeling of trust, being very forthcoming with the user of, hey, this is a beta or this is experimental technology. Give us your feedback. You know, a lot of what we do is let's learn as we go and bring the user in on the journey with us. Have the user kind of help us train the model as we go and give us feedback. Did this match your expectations? Did it not match your expectations? That kind of thing.
It sounds like these are some kind of unique UX considerations that come from working with AI. I guess I'm thinking back to other features we've done in the past where, I don't know, you're showing someone a graph. You may not have actual data connected to their account to show them, but you can at least show them what the graph looks like. And that's a little harder to do here if you don't have the model ready to interact with them. Are there any other like specific special UX considerations from AI that you found yourself facing?
I would say the biggest consideration has really been, how does our AI tooling interact with our existing tooling, and understanding, should it live as a layer aside from our typical UX? Should we integrate it in? What's the right moment to integrate it in? A lot of these have been unknowns that we want to just get something out there and understand how users are going to interact with it. You know, we've learned so much once it's been live that we could have never predicted through traditional design testing. So yeah, I would say the biggest consideration is just speed and getting it out there so that we can learn and iterate and make it better. I think too, one more thing to add is, you know, I talk a lot about building trust, transparency. These are all things that you want to do no matter what you're designing for. When it comes to AI, there's something so special about the experience. There's something magical about the experience. AI has a long wait time, for example, right now. Some of our generations can take up to 10 seconds, which can feel like a lifetime for users. How do you kind of use that to your advantage in the design and maybe build anticipation and excitement rather than an eye roll? Oh, here we go again. I have to wait a really long time. You know, there's something magical about AI in that you don't know what you're going to get. And it's kind of fun. And we want to create that element of play where it's actually really an enjoyable experience to interact with the tool. It might not be the silver bullet that we all thought it would be right out of the gate. You know, it might not solve all of your problems today, but it's exciting enough and fun enough to play with that I'm willing to interact with it. And the more users are willing to interact with it, the more we can learn and the more we can make the experience better and ultimately figure out what the real value is in this technology.
Rola, I've got a similar question from your perspective as the product manager here. You've worked on a lot of data science features here at Klaviyo, and I'm curious, did working with AI for this feature lead to any interesting or unique types of decision-making that you haven't really had to make in other features in data science?
That's a great question, and it seems similar to Alex's answer in the sense that we do have hypotheses. We do understand what are the cases that we want to support first. But we don't know exactly how customers are going to interact with this. So we go with this hypothesis, we release something, we learn from customers, and customers may use the tool differently as we expected before we release it. So being flexible and iterate is particularly important for this feature. As you were saying, Michael, in other features, you may know that you want to show a specific set of data and you may want to iterate because the data may not be super clear. And as you release, you realize that customer may get a bit confused. Here is like bigger than that. It's not only how you show the data, but what data you show and basically what customers want to do with that data. You have hypothesis again, but you don't know exactly how customers are going to use it. And that iteration, that flexibility is key to understand what is the next step. Where do I go after? So again, it just reinforced what Alex was saying from the UX side is the same thing for the product side. Just figure out how customers are using it, what are they doing, and just modify your understanding.
Manu, how about from the engineering side? What are some of the challenges that come with building an engineering solution like Segments AI, where a core part of the process is using an LLM?
That's a great question. I think we've touched on many things and we've faced like different issues just because of the nature of the feature. Touching on something that was mentioned previously by Carola, engineers love deterministic systems. So many things that we do in engineering, like our bot makes something predictable, anticipate to something that is predictable, like high speeds of load, things like that. These kind of problems are completely different in nature. I think that navigating that uncertainty is tricky from a system perspective. How do you, in terms of integration for the record, I don't think it's that problematic. It's just, let's say, another HTTP call to a third-party service or a self-hosted service. So in terms of integration or like the engineering architecture, is not as complicated. I think the complexity comes in the nature of the response more than the system itself. I'm thinking of like different things like, and I think Alexander touched on this, like just because of the nature of the UX and the UI, you're touching many domains. That also from an engineering perspective, sometimes it's not great in the sense that you're touching many domains and that hurts sometimes your domain boundaries with other teams. So I think that needs a lot of like leadership and sponsorship because that can go against some like even good principles from your engineering org, right? I'm very happy that we were able to navigate that, but I mean, that can generate like some friction along the way because you may be disrupting some existing domains that belong to other teams. So I think that's something that as long as you have the right sponsorship, it's fine, but that can create some friction with other domains. The lack of determinism, like we mentioned, the biggest challenge there, in my opinion, there is like, how do we avoid regressions of the system, capture them sufficiently ahead of time and in a cost-effective way? I think that the cost part is not negligible. Some of these systems are very expensive. So adding these tests to the usual way of doing things in engineering, sometimes it's not even an option just because of cost limitations. For instance, like other engineering processes may have continuous integration processes that run every time you try to change something. Running those sorts of end-to-end validation tests can be very expensive. So you have to come with some middle ground and some other ways of doing this when it makes sense, not every single time because of the cost. And last thing, like I think we came up with sort of a framework. It's not like super established framework, but as we've been building all of these features, I think we start identifying certain common patterns in all of the solutions. I think we're still early in our process as a company to properly build this system. So I think we're all learning. And so seems to be the community around LLMs. But some common things that we see everywhere is that almost every generative AI application needs context. Almost every generative AI application needs feedback. So I think that's something that we're seeing almost everywhere. And in terms of like the internals of the system, certain guardrails on the inputs and the outputs seem to be necessary. The inputs may be make sure that you don't leak certain sensitive information from your customers. The output may be make sure you're responding in a tone that is aligned with your brand as a company. And the three other things that I can think of is observability. The observability tools are being built as we speak. So sometimes relying on traditional observability tools is not easy because they're not built for LLMs, if that makes sense. And the two last ones, and I won't go too deep into this because I probably will have many things to add here, but evaluation, what I was mentioning before, like evaluation and validation, especially end-to-end of the system, in terms of de-risking initiatives, I think it's very worth it to explore potential like different providers. So make sure that you're not cobbled with just one provider. It's something that I would recommend everyone that is trying to build these kind of systems. In our case, we've been exploring multiples. It may be different third-party providers or it may be self-hosted open source models when it makes sense. You have the economies of a scale. But I think that's pretty much it at a high level. And in terms of like front-end, to be more specific, just to mention one last thing. This is related to what Alexander mentioned on UX, but waiting times can be hard. I think that's something that we're learning right now, to be very honest, but trying to make the most out of those waiting times and handling them properly. We try to reduce some of that with caching, for instance. Like if someone repeats the exact same input, we need to recreate it. So it's not just in terms of time to response, but also in terms of cost. Like if someone asks for the exact same thing, give it to them quickly. The last thing I will mention on feedback is that we tend to think about feedback in terms of explicit and implicit feedback after your release. But for me, one of the biggest learnings from this experience is to test things early. And we've seen this on other projects doing paint indoor experiments. That's something that we've done for other use cases. We didn't have time to do this for segments, but that was a learning too. Ask customers. You may be surprised. They may be willing to give you more information than you thought. That was a learning from another project and it was actually a learning from this project. But ask customers early. It would save you from some headaches.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an engineer. I can maybe add a little bit too. I think that one of the fun things about like working on these generative features is you get to kind of brush off your whiteboarding / system design skills. Because to some degree, some of these requests that we generate to GPT like are still opaque to us as well. Why it works in case A, but not case B. So just making sure you have like really clearly designed hierarchies that are logically consistent and stuff, because you can't necessarily break into whatever GPT-4, Claude, whatever model you're using is thinking to understand like why it's not working in a specific instance. So having clearly designed systems, I think, helps a lot.
So obviously we cannot leave out data science here. Rob, you started to answer as an engineer there, but you were also one of the main data scientists involved in building this feature. You know, generally it's easier to imagine what a data scientist does when we're building a regression model or a classification model or doing some more standard data science work like that. But it might be less obvious what a data scientist does in a project like this, where we're heavily working with a large language model. What was that process like?
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of an old joke, which I'll mangle, which is that like a data scientist is someone who's mediocre at statistics and mediocre at engineering. But I think like increasingly that's becoming even more true of whatever is data science has gotten so broad. Like having a theoretical knowledge of the Poisson distribution or whatever is not going to help you write better prompt engineering. And in fact, is not actually necessary at all to do that. So I think we're kind of like flying in uncharted areas, I would say. It's something that's tough of kind of like staying to the top of the literature because new libraries are coming out consistently of like generating better prompting structures, evaluating different prompting structures. New papers are coming out of trying to understand how to get LLMs to do the things that you want in the most effective way possible. It's very rapidly changing.
I may get in hot water with the Poisson distribution enjoyers for saying this, but I would say I don't think you actually need to know how to model the Poisson distribution to do data science well. It doesn't model much real-world data very well. But that aside, I do want to ask a follow-up question here, which is, given how broad the field of data science is, given how much is involved here, I am curious, were there any unique data science challenges that you faced on this project that you didn't expect or haven't really seen before in other work you've done in data science?
Yeah, so I think two things. One is validation, which Manu already mentioned here. We are outside of the world of square data sets, as I kind of, for lack of a better term. We're not doing OLS regression. In fact, we're not even doing an LLM task like classifying a piece of text. Is this Shakespearean or not? We're completely outside of that. We're dealing with a many-to-many problem space where there is no ground truth for what the correct answer to a creative generation is. In fact, the same input can map to multiple jointly correct outputs. So it is a very difficult thing to validate when you have no ground truth. And even if you did have ground truth, you're not sure if that's even the data you should be using because it's a many-to-many mapping. I think that we're still trying to figure out exactly the right way to do this as a company. I would say it probably is on a project-to-project basis, though. Where we came down on this is that it's useful to have a directional validation suite that you can kind of run before deploying things to hopefully avoid any regressions. And then also combining that with just listening to what customers say. That's ultimately just much more important than whatever validation suite you use, because ultimately any validation suite you use for these non-deterministic many-to-many outputs is going to be flawed in some way. So just making sure you understand those flaws and can live with them. And I would say the second thing, which is kind of like a unique challenge for these type of tasks, is what we might call like chain entropy or something. What I mean by that is Segments AI is a very hierarchical system. So you're making many LLM calls to generate outputs iteratively. So you can imagine that a series of 10, for example, LLM calls, all with inputs of the prior call feeding into the next one. As you might imagine, this is kind of like playing LLM telephone, and you might have a cruft kind of find its way in there. So an extra quotation mark can lead to disaster if you're trying to evaluate the outputs and use them in code later on. Since we're trying to make this useful for an internal process, we need to be able to ultimately translate these outputs to objects and stuff so we can automatically evaluate it. We're not just putting whatever the output into a chatbot window. We need to be able to use this. So being able to evaluate it is critically important and is something that can become difficult with lots and lots of calls. That sort of issue is difficult in text-to-object tasks, and I think is when there are errors, probably like often the cause of them. And it's something that's very opaque, I would say, to the end user. It's something we did a number of rounds on and got increasingly good at, I would say. One of the things we learned is kind of the GPT series models tend to be better at this type of text-to-object mapping. And kind of think of it like some LLMs are better at some tasks versus others, like AMD and Intel chips are kind of good at some tasks and good at others. So it's been a fun thing to kind of like compare different models and understand strengths and weaknesses.
Do you have any theories as to why that is for GPT-based models? Is it because that they're also trained on a large body of code and are able to execute that? Or I don't know, just curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah. So unfortunately, as kind of more money has entered the space, OpenAI has kind of strayed from releasing all the internals and data of their models. So we can't like exactly replicate what their training data sets are. We can make some guesses. I would say they've had a head start and have generated probably a more holistic training data set, seemingly. So if you look at multitask performance, like GPT-4 tends to be roughly the state of the art in most of these different tasks, in part seemingly because they likely have more examples of code, for example, mixed in with like free text, mixed in with generating JSONs, mixed with all these sorts of things. So since they have a more varied training data set, I would assume they're getting better outputs. I mean, most of the architecture is very similar. They're essentially, it's transformers all the way down. So there's not a huge amount of architectural innovation currently, but I'd love that change.
So as we know, and as we've discussed on this podcast before, the process of building is not over when a feature ships. And in many ways, shipping is really just the beginning. We've heard so far in this episode that we've learned a lot since Segments AI went live. What are some examples of what we've learned?
I mentioned this earlier, but one of the things we've learned from a user perspective is just what the value is that users are getting out of this tool. You know, they're not just using it to save time. They're using it to learn something they didn't know how to do or figure out how to do something that was complicated to figure out on their own. Understanding the user behavior of when they go to our classic builder versus when they go to the AI builder and why has been an interesting learning point. It's not a clear cut, now that AI is out there, I'm going to just use AI because it's faster than the classic tooling. There are still use cases where the classic builder is the preferred path to go. So really understanding why users are looking to AI versus the usual path has been an interesting learning.
Customers don't distinguish between generative AI and smarter AI that potentially includes their data. And I'm like making that distinction not very well. They don't distinguish between something that potentially is just creating something and creating something smarter. I think customers, when they look at these tools, they one or expect, even if we are not currently doing it, is that the recommendation is a good recommendation that will help them to generate better performance. And that's a learning that we keep having every time that we talk to customers. That distinguish is very blurry in their mind.
Yeah, I mean, as others have mentioned, a lot of folks come to these tools just honestly, even just for inspiration, not necessarily even just for automation. And I think it's one of the things we learned both from like systems design perspective, as well as like a UX customer experience perspective, that like creativity, having the right path to start down, like an interesting idea of the right segment to build or SMS to write, whatever kind of like task we're using LLMs for, is more important than whatever downstream stuff we do to execute that. So being able to get those structures right is just the most important thing you can do.
As always, I would like to end this podcast with some practical advice to our listeners. I imagine many of our listeners out there are either in the process of or thinking about building a solution that's similarly powered by AI. What's one piece of concrete advice you would have for someone who's in that situation?
I think we've touched on this. I think it's related to the feedback part. Test early. I know it's a very simple one, but we did many internal testing sessions. I think we learned a lot from those. Of course, like what you may be able to learn from your employees or your colleagues may not be aligned with what users may do with the tool, but testing early would be my most important suggestion.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on who we're giving advice to. If you're just an individual trying to build out your interview showcase or just trying to learn more, just try it out. Build something simple. There are lots of accounts you can get free API credit and just start generating something. I would say if you're a team, like a data science team or a product team, you do, I think, really have to think more deeply about how you can avoid having whatever you're building just be a wrapper around ChatGPT that anyone else could build. Ultimately, you're spending a lot of money and development time to put this together. And I think people, from a novelty perspective, are starting to get past seeing believable text and they want it like to generate value. So making sure you're focused on like what is the customer need, what is this going to help them do, is, I think, more important than just another chatbot.
Also, the space is changing and customers are still learning how to use these tools. So again, we have mentioned so many times, you had to be flexible, you had to learn, you had to like improve as you work with the customers. So customer expectations today may not be the same in 6 months from now, because there are going to be so many other tools that are doing different things that the customers are going to evolve as we evolve our tools.
This is a general rule of thumb for building software in general, but I think it applies extra when you're building for AI. Really think through what that MVP experience is and drill it down. Get something live out there as fast as you can. You don't need to build a fully functioning chatbot, a fully functioning model before you release something. Don't be afraid to be wrong. Just get it out there. Get people using it, because there's only so much guessing you can do until it's live in people's hands. So that would be my biggest advice.
Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. I have learned a ton from talking over this feature and how we built it with everyone. It was a pleasure to have all of you on. Thank you so much for being here. And I look forward to talking to you again and learning more about AI and how to use it properly. I think it's an important conversation that's only going to become increasingly important as time goes on. So thank you all for being on today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
This episode, as all episodes of the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast are, was sponsored by Klaviyo. Klaviyo powers smarter digital relationships, make it easy for marketers to centralize and use every piece of their customer data to deliver hyper-personalized experiences across all their channels, which increases conversions and revenue. If you liked what you heard on this episode of the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast, if you like hearing about how we use AI and how we try to not just deliver an AI product, but actually deliver value with AI, then go ahead and subscribe to the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast. You should be able to do that wherever you're listening to it. Also, please feel free to leave us a rating, a thumbs up, a 5 stars. Please leave us a review if you enjoyed the episode, or leave us a comment on the publicly posted discussion question if you have any thoughts on this matter. Also, feel free to contact me if you have any questions, comments, or concerns about what you heard on this episode. I am the best person to reach. The best place to reach me is my Twitter account. That's Lawson_M_T, LAWSON_M_T. Thank you for listening. Have a great month.